What are you all doing here? On a wet and cold Sunday morning like this? You should be snuggled up under a blanket, maybe having a nice cup of hot chocolate. What are you doing here? Did they say we were maybe releasing the new iPhone or something? Or perhaps unveiling the new BMW sports coupe? Limited edition. What are you doing here? Or Nicki Minaj's new album? Honestly, what are you doing here? It's too cold out there to get out of bed and come all this way? No? You must be feeling pretty blessed then. Actions speak louder than words, and your actions have spoken. At least for some of you, I'm sure, as you woke up this morning and you looked out the window and the rain splattering, you must have thought, must we? They put it on YouTube anyway. Must we? Oh, just go back to sleep. But perhaps there was someone else at home. Maybe it was your little boy. Who said, Ami, come on, let's go. Or was it Ami who said that? I don't know. Different homes, it's a different way, you know, who gets to call the shots. Anyway, somehow you've all managed to get yourselves here, which is quite the achievement. Because it takes great courage and no small amount of conviction to bring yourselves here. Can you all hear me at the back? Right at the back? Yeah? Excellent. So you have yourselves to thank for bringing yourselves here. And as I said, actions speak louder than words, so your actions have spoken. And it shows me that you have understood that there's a change that needs to happen within yourselves. And you're willing to make that change. That is marvelous. Magnificent. Well done. So when I see that you're making your effort to make that transformation in your life, go that extra mile to actually do something useful with your lives, then there's a calling from above that says, serve them, do good by them, ensure that they get the most out of their journey this morning.
I will.
So, without any further ado then, let us make headway. Before we commence then, let us all take a moment to pay homage to the glorious one, the infinitely compassionate one, the undefeated one, the unvanquished one, he who is the teacher of 10,000 world systems, our master, our guide, the supremely enlightened one, the Buddha. And as we bring our palms together in veneration, let us also remind ourselves that we are here with purpose and we are here to achieve the ultimate bliss of Nibbana.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Right. Do we have any newcomers this morning? Now, I want you all to do yourselves a favor. So these days, We are continuing a series. And we build on this week after week. So one of the best things you can do for yourselves is to do your best. I know there will be times where it's not going to be possible or convenient. Do try your best to bring yourselves here. Because it is one thing to watch it, if I can use the metaphorical phrase, right from the horse's mouth. And it's another to then go back and watch it on YouTube. Because you do know that the environment supports. Here you are in the presence of those who are all focused on this. But of course, when you are on YouTube, you know, that's just one other video on YouTube. And you do know that once you get that up on there, on the right hand side, what else do they have? Invitations. To take you astray. Could we interest you in? Recommendations. And then, soon enough, you can get lured sideways. And then before you know it, you're lost on YouTube. I mean, that's how they are designed. That's how they make their money. So, you've got nothing against that. But you can do yourselves a service by doing your level best to bring yourselves here. Because there's one real advantage of being here, and that is I can read your faces. So I can read your face. Sometimes I can see that your faces have a wide smile, like this. Sometimes it's a grim, like this. Sometimes you look really confused. Then I know that I have changed my tact. Sometimes your eyes are closed shut. Then I know I really have to change tact. But when you're at home watching this on YouTube, I can't read you. So, to receive the fullest of what Swami Nuhanse has to offer, I think it would make sense to bring yourselves in whenever you can. That is not to say I hold anything against you if you don't get to be here. In fact, it is not me who should hold anything against you. It should be yourselves who has to hold something against you in the event that you are unable to get here. So we are all here for ourselves. As much as you might think I'm very kind and so generous, I'm actually here for myself as well. Because you keep paying me, don't you? Yes. I come here for merits. I come here to share in your merits. You earn merits by listening to the talk. I earn merits by doing the talk. It is not my intention to just carry on doing talks for the rest of samsara. That's not what I'm here for. Soon enough, someone among you will be ready for it. Someone will prepare. One of you will be prepared for it. And right now, I'm preparing you for it. You don't even know it. Soon enough, you will start preaching the Dhamma. See, the Buddha is not here today, although he was the one who started this all. When the Mara invited the Buddha, on three occasions he came and made that invitation. It is said in the scriptures, on three occasions. He said, Buddha, enough of this. Is it not time to go? And on all three occasions the Buddha said, Mara, you mind your own business. Right? I have come here with purpose. As soon as I have fulfilled that purpose, excuse me. As soon as I have fulfilled that purpose, I don't need an invitation. I will be going. So thank you very much. Goodbye. He said that once, and the Mara wouldn't listen to him, came back a second time, made the same invitation, and he still wouldn't listen, and he came back a third time. And on the third time, that was the last time that invitation was made. And on that occasion, the third occasion, the Buddha accepted it. So on the third occasion, the Buddha said, how timely, Mara, because I actually have fulfilled my purpose as the Supremely Enlightened One. I now have plenty and more disciples who have understood the Dhamma and who will for here on proclaim the Dhamma and preach the Dhamma. They will travel by foot from country to country. They will travel the world across the globe, sharing the Buddha's wisdom, sharing the wisdom of Nibbana, sharing the message of freedom with all, and help many sentient beings, devas, brahmas, humans and so on, to free themselves from suffering, and so therefore my job is done. From 3 full moons from this day, in 3 full moons from this day, I shall pass away into Parinibbana, said the Buddha. So, likewise, it is not my intention to be here preaching to you every day. There has to be a day where someone else, perhaps someone amongst you, will come and take this seat and then carry on. Because this is a relay race. It's not a one-man band. It never was, and it can't be so. The sasana cannot prevail in that manner. The sasana cannot prevail. My teacher always tells me this, and it's such a wonderful instruction. My teacher tells me, if the sasana is for real, right? If we are doing the real sasana, you must perish and the sasana must prevail. If you're in a sasana where the sasana perishes and you prevail, that is not the Buddha sasana. I think these are wonderful words of advice, golden words of wisdom. Because that is what the sasana is for, so that I can perish. So that I don't have to hang around forever suffering. But the message, the teaching that helps people to free themselves from suffering, that must certainly prevail. So that others who walk this path for time to come, in many years to come, thousands of years to come, centuries to come, in millennia to come, they will still be able to walk this path and work towards freedom from oneself. So that is what we're here for. That is why whenever we do these talks, whenever you make offerings and so on, you know, we always say, do not make it to a private, do not make it a private offering, do not make it a personal offering, because it is not the person who are here that is important, it is the sasana. The sasana, long live the sasana, long live not me. Long live the king. No, long live the sasana, the Buddha sasana, long live the Buddha sasana. May the sasana prevail for many, many, many years to come. So how does the sasana prevail? What must we do for that? Shall we all get together and build a big pagoda? Shall we? Shall we build a big shrine room? How about that? Or an 80-foot tall Buddha statue? What do you say? They help, but they're not the be-all and end-all. For the sasana to prevail, ladies and gentlemen, you must understand the Dhamma. That is how the sasana prevails. Sabba papa sakarana, you know this, right? Kusalasa upasampada sachitta pariyodapana etam buddhasana sasana. Etam buddhana sasana. So where do these three things happen? Sabba papa sakarana, where does it happen? Brick and mortar? No. In the minds of the sravakas. Kusalasa upasampada. So refraining from all evil doings. Engaging in meritorious deeds. Kusalasa upasampada. Where does that happen? In the minds of sentient beings, such as you and I. Sachitta pariyodapana. Taming the mind, freeing the mind. Engaging the mind in the noble path and achieving ultimate bliss. Where does that happen? Of course, in the mind. Sachitta pariyodapana. Chitta pariyodapana. Etam buddhana sasana. That is my sasana, is the Buddha's teaching. So there's a cultural aspect to the sasana, certainly. And you see that. And from country to country, that will change. So the Buddhism that you see, the culture that you see in Sri Lanka will be different to the culture that you see, might see in Thailand. Maybe in Burma, if you've traveled the world, you know, they have different cultures. So there's a cultural aspect of anything, right? There's a cultural aspect of how you treat your parents. Right from that to how the Buddha sasana works, right? There's a cultural aspect. But culture is not Buddha anusasana. It is not the rites and the rituals. That is not the Buddha Sasana. You are the Buddha Sasana. It is what you do that promotes the Buddha Sasana. So if you care about the effort that the Buddha made, if you care so deeply about the Bodhisattva and how much he sacrificed himself for our deliverance, to discover the path and then to teach it to all of us, and from there on, from the great elder Sariputta, Mahakassapa, Mahamoggallana, and the great Theris, Uppalavanna, Patachara, Kisagotami, Bhadrakachayana, and so on. Right? The great Theris and the Theras who passed on this teaching right down to us, where today we have it from our teachers. If we care about that, if we care passionately about what they have done for us, then the one thing that we must all do is to follow in that path. Take on that teaching, practice it for ourselves, and do those three things. Sabba papa sakarana, kusala supa sampada, sachitta pariyodapana. Do these three things and you are doing the Buddha Sasana. So it matters not how much you have in your pocket or how much you have in your bank. That is not the Buddha Sasana. The Buddha Sasana happens within you. That is why we speak to you. These words are intended to make a change. These words are intended to influence you to act, think differently, just a little bit differently every day. I'm not expecting you to make leaps overnight. I'm expecting you to take one small step every day, just a tiny inch. You know, one behavior, half of it, every day, with consistency. That is how we reap results. A little done every day brings you results. That is why I'm not an advocate of individuals who perhaps come and listen to one sermon and say, I want to become a monk, Swami. I want to become a monk. I'm not a great fan of that. Because most of the time, you know, they are hasty in making their decisions and then they regret at leisure. If you come into the sasana one day, and I'm sure for some of you that will be true. By sasana I mean in this way, right? I'm dead certain. Because, you know, if you preach to 1,000 people, perhaps 5 of them will, if they've got enough merits, you need an extortionate amount of merits, an unimaginable amount of merits to actually make this jump. But that is what you're doing. You are acquiring the merits. You are accruing the merits. Right? Perhaps if not this time, maybe next time. Maybe the time after that. Perhaps the time after that. Now one day it will happen for you. It didn't happen for me earlier. Now, it didn't happen for me in previous births. It's happened for me this time round. And in the same way, it'll happen for you someday. But that may not be for everyone. Nonetheless, the truth is for everyone. The sasana is for everyone. So there's a way you can attain to Nibbana by engaging in this practice. There's also a way you can engage in Nibbana the way you are doing it. It is tougher on that side of the fence. It is much more difficult. I know it because I've been there. It is very difficult. It is far more easier on this side. Much more easier. Because the environment is super conducive to that. You have your teachers always by your side, watching you, watching every step you take. Because in this life, there are no secrets. Whereas, in that life, in your life, there are plenty of places to hide. In my life, there is no incognito mode. But in your life, there will be plenty of opportunities for that. So there's no hiding. Because we are always under the watchful eyes of the Mahasangha. And it's a constant practice. Every waking moment, we are encouraged to practice. Not because it has to be done. Because it is the only thing that can be done, or that needs to be done, and that is worth doing. So one day it will happen for you, I'm sure. One day, I don't know when that day will be. But whether that happens or not, what I urge you is to make sure that you have set your mind focused on your salvation. And so care not about whether it is going to happen for you one day when you robe, or as you are in this position, right, just ensure that you do these three things. Sabba papa sakarana, kusala supa sampada, and sachitta pariyodatana. Just take the five precepts for a second before we delve into some of the nitty-gritty of last week. The five precepts for a second. Take the first one. Panadipata. Veramani. Can you still hear me? Thank you. Panadipata Veramani. Sikkhapadan Samadhyam. Each of these precepts, they have a superficial meaning and they also have a very profound meaning. There's an underlying meaning behind all of these. In fact, even as lay individuals, although you think that when we observe the five precepts, we get to live a holy but, you know, comfortable lay life, without your knowledge, what you're actually observing is the path to Nibbana. Panatipata is the nature of an arahant. What you're doing is a Sikkhapadang Samadhyam. Now, when I was much younger, as a young child, I thought this Samadhyami part was me asking the monk to excuse me, to forgive me. That's what I used to think. See how naive I was? For all my transgressions, for all my sins, for all my bad deeds, Aneham Durune Samadhyam. Samadhyam. That's what I thought I was saying. I didn't realize until later that it was not me asking for their forgiving, but rather I was actually observing. It's an observation. You're precepting. Sikkhapadam. Sikkha is training. It is a training. Shikshana. Sikkha is training. If you've seen these training hospitals, you've seen what they put on the outside, on the boards. Shikshana Rohada. Yeah, training hospital. That is what Sikkha is, training. So a precept is a training. Now, here's the interesting part about this, okay? Hear me out. Panatipata, Veramani, Sikkhapadam, Samadhyami. Samadhyami, now we understand, it is not me asking for forgiveness. I'm sure none of you thought it that way, I'm just expressing how foolish I was when I was younger. But it is, of course, me taking it on. Right? So I take on the precept. That is what Samadhyami is. Sikkhapadang is the precept, meaning the practice, the training. I take on the training. Panatipata Veramani. Now here's the interesting part here. Panatipata, or refraining from taking the life of another, is only the end product of this training. It is not what you're training for. Let me repeat that. Panatipata Veramani is not really what you're training for. Or it's not the training. The training is something else, and the result is Panatipata Veramani. I'll give you an analogy. Let's say you're doing weight training at the gym. Okay? You're doing some weight training. Now when you do weight training, the intention is not to be weight training in the gym forever. You're doing that for something else. Let's just say you have you want to become fitter, for instance. Okay? That's a good example to take. Let's say you want to become fitter, you want to become healthier, right? You've been to the doctor lately and the doctor said you better get some exercise, right? You're not looking very good, so you better get some exercise. So you go to the gym and you start working out. Maybe perhaps you do some weight training, maybe you run on the bicycle, right? You do some aerobics, anaerobics, right? You do the lot. Now, the intention here of going to the gym is not that you become a lifetime member of the gym and just be in the gym forever. It's a means to an end. The end is not being in the gym, is it? The end is becoming fitter, becoming healthier, being able to live a better life, a healthier life, longevity, right? But for that, you go to the gym. So going to the gym is not the end of it. It's only the journey. Your destination, your objective is another, to be able to live a good life. In fact, if you go to the gym enough times, if you work out enough times, if you do it well enough, then the objective should be that you should no longer have to go to the gym, right? Yeah? If you're doing it right, you shouldn't have to go to the gym again. I'm not talking about someone who does it as a hobby. I'm talking about someone who's decided to go to the gym because they want to get fitter, healthier. The doctor said you need to get yourself some exercise, right? Your stats are not looking so good. So please, in 6 months' time, come back for another test and let's make sure your cholesterol levels, your sugar levels, your blood pressure, you know, it's all looking good. So in those 6 months, I want you to work on your diet and I also want you to work on your body. Okay? So for those 6 months, you get yourself a gym subscription, you go to the gym and you start working out. Now, your intention after the 6 months is to do what? Go back to the doctor, get your blood check, and for the doctor to give you a thumbs up and say, yeah, that's all good. Now just carry on living a normal life. You don't have to go back to the gym so often. You know, unless you are someone who enjoys going to the gym is a punishment. I used to go to the gym. So it's a, personally, if you ask me, It's a punishment, it's a self-inflicted punishment. But I had to. Because it was a bit too late when I realized that the stuff that you put into your mouth can have dire consequences. And it starts clogging up your arteries and it starts doing damage to your liver. It was a little bit too late when I realized that, but not too late. Early enough for me to start to make some changes in my diet and so on. So I remember going to the gym. I used to do it every day after work. I'd go to the gym, spend about an hour there, doing some lifts, doing some running, doing some exercises and so on, right? So, but I never wanted to be there. I was only going there because I had to, not because I wanted to. Does that make sense to you? That's an analogy, right? Now let me relate that back to what I was trying to explain to you earlier. The training that we need to do has nothing to do with refraining from killing. When you come here, do I tell you every day, don't kill, don't kill, don't kill, don't kill? No, I don't do that. I talk to you about the truth of the world. I talk to you about anicca. I talk to you about dukkha. I talk to you about anatta. The three characteristics of all existence. We'll start talking about these things in a moment. I talked about the mind and the body. I talked to you about the Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. How the mind works. How cognition happens. How perception happens. I talk about these things. But at the beginning of the sermon, what do? We observe precepts. But I never tell you don't steal. I never say don't engage in sensual or sexual misconduct. I don't tell you not to lie. But I get you to observe the precept of refraining from lying. But I don't train you how not to lie, do I? Have you ever given you any training on how not to kill? No. But is that not the precept you observe at the beginning? Panatipata veramani sikkha padang samadhyami. Now if that was on the course document, right? Imagine we were all doing a course, right? And if it was on the syllabus, you would expect me to come and teach you how not to kill. Just imagine that was the course you were taking. And on the course document, the course syllabus, prospectus, it said, Panatipata veramani, adinadana veramani, kamesumichachara veramani, musavada veramani. Oh, and the most popular favorite one, the last one, suramere, majjapama. Just a little bit, not too much, not too little, just a little bit majjapama. Oh God, how creative people are. Huh? So, needs must when the devil drives. Needs must. When people want to get something, they will warp even the Buddha's teachings. They will distort even the Buddha's teachings to get what it is that they want. So the Buddha said what? In case you wish to take intoxicants, please only take a little. Said the Buddha. Really? So, including that one. Now, you know, in our sermons, right from when we started, what, you know, back 6, 7, 8, about 10 years ago, we've been doing sermons for that long, right? I have never, as far as I can remember, I have never instructed or advised anyone not to take drinks or alcohol or intoxicants. I never have done that. I've never done that. Because that is just the end result. It is not the training. This going to the gym is the training. Getting fitter, getting healthier is the end result. There's no point in going to the gym and the gym instructor coming and telling you, get fitter, get healthier. So what you'd ask them is, well, tell me how. Won't you? Yeah, you tell me to get fitter, but how? Tell me what should I do? That is what you'd ask them. So although we observe the precepts, right, and you chant this every day, every morning, Panatipata Veramani, when you get here, I'm not going to tell you don't kill. I mean, that's obvious. Do I need to tell you not to kill? Do you think you need the Buddha to come and teach you not to kill? Yes, the five precepts appear in the Tripitaka. There are places where it appears. But the Buddha's message is not to kill. You don't need the Buddha to say that. Mahatma Gandhi will say that just as well. You don't need the Buddha to teach you that. Don't steal. Do you think you need the Buddha to teach you that? No. Do unto others how you would like to be done to yourselves. Or treat others how you would like to be treated. You don't need the Buddha to teach you that. But here's what you need the Buddha to teach you. How do you not want to steal? That's a different conversation altogether. Refraining from stealing when you want to steal is a discipline. Yeah, it's a discipline. It's like saying, you know, when you're in public, please behave properly. Why do people have to be informed and advised that? Like also, like, you know, maybe in our country, we say, you know, don't kiss in public. Public displays of affection. Right? Now, in other cultures, you know, that is perfectly fine. But in our culture, you know, we don't do that a lot. Public displays of affection. You know, perhaps the most you do is probably hold someone's hand. But nothing more than that. Typically, I'm speaking. Right? So why do people say that? Why perhaps sometimes you'll have both somewhere saying, you know, public displays of affection. Please do not do here. What that means is people want to do it. Just don't do it here. Yeah? No smoking. What does that mean? It means people want to smoke, but just don't do it here. If no one wanted to smoke, do you think they'd need that boat? If no one wanted to smoke, do you think they'd need that boat? No, they wouldn't. So you see, discipline is when you want to do things, but they shouldn't be done. Now in the Buddha's code of conduct that he laid out for the monks as well, we have 227. 227 rules of conduct. You have 5. I have 227 to abide by. But how come I'm happier than you? It's not impeding on my happiness. I don't feel like I'm stifled. I don't feel that way. I don't feel like the Buddha's code of conduct is suffocating me. I don't feel that way. I feel relaxed. Because the rules that are laid down, these are the disciplines. Discipline is necessary For when you shouldn't be doing something that you would normally want to do. That is what discipline is. Would you all agree with me on that? Yeah? Please walk in a straight line. Please only park on the left-hand side. Please only drive on the right-hand side. Please maintain 2 chevrons distance between yourself and the car in front of you. Because what might you want to do? Get closer. Tailgate. Please indicate before you turn. Because what might you want to do? Not do that. So there's discipline to force you, to get you to do things, because that has to be what we all do, otherwise we wouldn't be able to exist and coexist. Right? For cohabitants to be able to live with each other harmoniously, we all have to conform to a certain way of living. And that is what discipline is. Now coming back to the 5 precepts, Panatipata Veramani Sikkhapadang Samadhi. I mean, you will never hear me when you come here to tell you not to kill, because you don't need the Buddha, and therefore you don't need me to teach you not to kill. I think that is pretty damn obvious. But here's what you need. How do you not want to kill? I want to kill, but I won't. Now that's 2 different wants, right? Want with an A and want with an O. I won't kill, but I won't kill. I want to lie, but I won't lie. Have there never been times where you wanted to lie but you didn't lie? Never? Are you all saints? Have there never been times where you wanted to take something? Perhaps that didn't belong. Maybe, you know, maybe even in your younger years. Perhaps not today, you know, today, because you know there are other ways and means of getting things that you want. But maybe when you were younger. I remember, and I have confessed this to my parents. I have. When I was younger, I was, I think, in my grade 10. I know, a bit earlier than that. Grade 8, grade 9 sort of time. There was a trend that was going on. Everyone had a Walkman. Like the cool guys, they had a Walkman. Do you know what a Walkman is? Sorry, I have to ask that, because there will be people in this audience who may not know what a Walkman is. Because nowadays we don't use that stuff. Right? A Walkman is a little gadget into which you could put a cassette. It's a cassette player, but a portable one. I never thought I'd give a talk to an audience and explain to them what a Walkman is. But there we go. But Walkman actually is a brand name. It's Sony's brand name, right? It's a trade name for them. But it's a portable cassette player. So there was a time when I, in my younger years, where the cool guys, the posh guys, the cool guys, they had a Walkman with them, and I wanted one. So I started saving up pocket money, bus fare, lunch money. I started saving up. Because, you know, although my parents were able to afford many of the things I wanted, they always made it a point to not give me everything I wanted. And I love them for that. Even to this day, I'm so grateful that they did it that way. Because I learned the value of things. I learned that money don't grow on trees. I learned that lesson. I remember crying and begging for a bicycle, and they promised me, next exam, come first in class and you will get it. I kept coming first in class, I just didn't get the bicycle. It was always that carrot in front of this donkey. Whenever I would achieve something, something else would be hung in front of me and said, now get that and you will get the bicycle. I never got it. Because there was a kid around the block who had a bike. Today I realized that what my parents taught me was, how do I work with someone and share something that they have without, when I don't have my own? And I think that's a valuable trait, a valuable lesson to be taught to young children, especially, you know, children who live as siblings, brothers, sisters, right? Now, parents, I speak to you, right? If you have more than one child, right? If your children are siblings, I would suggest that you needn't get each one of everything. I suggest that you needn't do that. But they might ask you for it. If Mali has a computer, why can't I? If Mali has a bat, why can't I? If Mali has a PS5, why can't I? If Mali has a TV, why can't I? If Aya's got a room, why can't I? This is a mind that cannot be satisfied. So I would suggest that instead of doing that, teach them how to share. Because sharing is caring. Teach them that it's difficult to get these things. You've got to earn them. And it may be that, you know, you have enough of everything. Perhaps you're loaded. But there can be a time where it's too soon for your children to learn that. Perhaps, you know, you've got your, you know, there are things that have been passed down from generation to generation. You've got a large inheritance, perhaps. Don't let your children learn about it too soon. That would be spoiling them. This is just friendly advice, besides Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta. You have a question for that? Yeah? Sad. Wonderful, isn't it? So he's talking to me about how this Buddha is sharing the story about how he shares his Xbox with his sister. When she uses it, he lets him have it. When he uses it, she lets him have it. See? That he doesn't trouble his parents to buy him a separate Xbox. Now you learn how to share. What do people not know these days? They don't know how to share. Thank you for sharing that, Buddha. Well done. So, I know I'm taking a sidetrack here, but you know, from time to time, as we go to Hantana, right, we stop along the way, don't we? Get out and just look at the scenery, don't we? That's the way to enjoy a good trip, isn't it? Stop for a cup of tea, right, and then just carry on again. So we are on the way to Hantana. So I was saying, when I was younger, so I wanted this Walkman. And I was saving up for it. And there came a point where I used to go to this store that had this item. And I used to take a class in Maharagam. And every week I'd go there, and there was this one store in all of Maharagama that had this Walkman. There was just one store. So they had two of them when I first started my adventure. But as I was saving up, one day this person, the storekeeper, tells me, "Buddha, only one more left." Because almost every other week I'd go and ask him, "How much is it now?" In the hope that he might take kindly to me and perhaps give me a discount. But no, he wouldn't do that. But he would remind me, only one more left now. So by this point, I was about 2,000 rupees short. I'd saved enough with pocket money, but I was 2,000 rupees short. And then the devil got me. See, I wanted something. I wanted something and I didn't have it. I didn't know what to do about the wanting. But I'd learned math. I'd learned science. I'd learned history and social studies and geography and biology and English, good English. I was first in class. But what I didn't know was, when wanting strikes the mind, what do you do? The only thing I knew to do was, if you want it, get it. See, that is where my parents failed me. Because they didn't know the answer either. They were helpless. They taught me everything they knew. So they couldn't obviously teach me something that they didn't know, could they? So the devil got me. So one fine day, I was at home, father had gone out, and I was, Amma had asked me to clean the house, and as I was cleaning up, you know, I found Appachi's bag. So it was a little briefcase that he would carry around with him. And I thought, I wonder. I was only 2,000 rupees short. I thought, I wonder. So as if I got possessed. That's my excuse now anyway. I must have. I would never have thought of doing something like that, right? I'm such a saint. I would never have done something like that, but I got possessed. Right? So having been possessed, I opened this bag without his permission. Because what did I want? I wanted the Walkman. Did I know any other way of freeing myself from that pain, from that anguish, from the pain that was tugging at my heart of wanting this Walkman? I didn't know any other way. The only way I knew was, if I want it, go get it. That's all I knew. And what was the distance between me and the Walkman? 2,000 rupees. So all I had to do was cross that barrier, cross that bridge, cross that distance, and the Walkman would be mine. So open the bag, in went the hand. It wasn't me, I was possessed. I swear to God, I was possessed. I was possessed by the devil. In went the hand, and the hand came into contact with something that felt like money. Out came the hand, it went in empty, but it came out clenching a few notes. You should have seen the look on my face. I was half elated and half, there's a word, scared. You know the word. I'm not going to say it in a sermon. Dead scared. Okay? I was dead scared. Because this is the first time I was doing something like this. I wasn't a kleptomaniac. You know, I was not a habitual thief or anything of that. So, you know, I never stole. I didn't, because I didn't want to. I didn't have to. Any time I asked for something, I got it. But this time around, my parents didn't give me. Now, I didn't have the courage to ask them directly either. So I kept saying, you know, there are some friends in class and they've got this Walkman Appachi. Isn't that nice? And he said, yeah, it's nice. So? But he'd never let me have one. So out came the hand, clenched in it a few notes, and I thought to myself, this money is better in my pocket than in his bag. Money came out, bag closed, went in the pocket, and I was out of that room as soon as my little legs could carry me. Now, here's the thing. A few hours later, Appachi came home. See how you have to live with the consequences of your actions. To this day, I mean, you know, the day when I confessed to them, Appachi said he didn't even know that he had put some money in it. But you see, I didn't know that, did I? I thought that he probably had saved some money in there for something. But I didn't know that he didn't know that he had put money in it. But because I didn't know that, every time he would walk up to his bag, can you imagine what I was going through? Yeah? Every time he would walk up to his bag. Or, what about the times when he would say, Putha, can you fetch me my bag for me, please? Because what do you think he's going to get you to do now? Explain how the money went missing. See, once you've done the deed, you have to live with the consequences. These consequences, they, you know, you don't even have to believe in life after birth. Sorry, life after death. See, the consequences started coming to me immediately. Now what matters whether you are going to have to suffer this in hell? I was making hell for myself, wasn't I? Because as soon as I'd done the deed, inside of me, guilt was eating me up. There were plenty of times where I thought to myself, was that right of me to steal from my father? There were times I would hear that. The voice in the back of my head. Now imagine, you know, when I was taken to perhaps, you know, an almsgiving or something, and I had to say, Adinna dana verma, but I was lucky because at the end I could ask for forgiveness. Adinna dana vermani, sikkha padang samadhiha. So I used to comfort myself thinking, well, I've asked for forgiveness now from the Swami now. Say, surely he has forgiven me. But that wouldn't stop Apache from time to time asking me, get the bag, please. And every time he used to do that, a fire would light inside me and I would burn alive. It was such torture. I was tormenting myself. There were times I considered, shall I go and put the money back in the bag? But then, again, I was reminded, but what about the Walkman? I was really torn. So in the end, what do you think this story has? A good end or a bad end? Happy end or a sad end? Yeah, true, Buddha. Unfortunately, I didn't have the opportunities that you have today. So in the end, I took the money and I went to the store and I bought the Walkman. And now here's the thing. When you acquire goods that are stolen, you can't put them on display in public. That didn't occur to me until I bought it. Now I had with me a Walkman, which couldn't be explained how it was sourced, so I had to keep it hidden all the time. What good is a Walkman that you can't use? Now, I certainly couldn't take it to school because those things were not allowed at school. So the only place I could use it was at home. But I couldn't take it out at home because Amma and Appaji would come and ask me, how did you get that? I royally shot myself in the foot. I had a Walkman that I could not use. And I'd also committed a deed for which I suffered immensely. Every time I'd pick up the Walkman, you know, perhaps when the parents went out shopping or something, I'd pick it up and put the cassette in, try and plug the earphones in and listen to it. You know, I couldn't enjoy it. Because one ear would be on the music, the other ear would be on the door. No? Because we had dogs, but they were tamed. They wouldn't bark for family members. See what a hell I'd created for myself? See, for those of you who might be skeptical about whether there's a hell or not, I tell you, you know, we can create our own hells. I'd well and truly created a hell for myself with that one deed. And you know, it was not just the point at which I stole it, but what about every single time I thought about it and regretted it? Repentance is as sinful as the deed itself. Regret is as sinful as the deed itself, and I'll explain to you why that is. Because you feel that it is you who did the deed, and now you regret thinking it was you who did the deed. Regret is good because you make a confession, and it helps you to move on. But in the Buddha's teaching, regret is not a castle that you must build for yourself and live in. Regret doesn't help you move further. It stifles you. You've heard the story of Angulimala, the great Thera. Right? After he attained arahanthood, do you think he lived in regret? He was a saint. Do you think he lived in regret? Regret that he'd killed so many thousands of people? Do you think he lived in regret? No, no, no. Regret is not holy. Regret is torture. Self-torture. Now, there may be instances, situations in life, in your own life, ladies and gentlemen, where you've done similar deeds. Theft. Lying. You know, lying to your parents. Lying to your loved ones. Maybe lying to your spouse. Perhaps that was the lie that saved your marriage. Maybe. Perhaps today you think you did the right thing by lying to them. It's not my duty to ask you whether that is the right or wrong thing to have done, but you know, whenever you're reminded of it, that you have to put up a pretense in front of her or in front of him and pretend that that never happened. Because once you lie once, you have to maintain that lie. To cover up one lie, you need 100 more. So whenever you utter a lie, now you have to live in a web of lies. And once you start creating lies, you always have to be mindful of the lies that you have said, because you never know when you might say the next thing which is going to prove that the same thing you said before was a lie. But when you utter the truth, you've got nothing to maintain. You've got nothing to balance. Because the truth is self-sustaining. Whereas a lie requires you to sustain it. And there are plenty of times where, you know, people were, they were famous people, you know, what do you call them? The word escapes me. It'll come to me in a moment. Now, famous people who were rewarded, regarded as, you know, people who had achieved and accomplished great things in life, but then, and they were perhaps, you know, endowed with various investitures, as you know, maybe titles given to them, but posthumously they were all taken back from them when it came to light that they'd been up to no good. So even when you lie, or even when you die, the lie still lives on. After you're dead, there's no one there to sustain the lie. So when you die, one day the lie will come back to life. And then all that good grace that you managed to maintain in your life, while you were maintaining that lie, all that is gone. And then even, you know, people will come and curse your dead body. They will curse your tomb. So the long and short of all of this is, anyway, what we train here to do is not to refrain from lying or refrain from killing or refrain from stealing. That is the end product. That is the result of the training. That is why you will never hear me tell you don't steal, don't lie, don't backstab. That is the end result. Because when a mind goes into vexation, when your mind goes into vexation, it knows of nothing else than coming out of it. Right? If I ask you to bend your finger backwards, and I keep doing that until the pain is unbearable, at this point you want nothing more than release from this, right? Agreed? Yeah. Just think about it. Let's say we were in a room where it was expected that you remain drop dead silence. It is required that you maintain drop dead silence, but you feel the need to sneeze. Now you feel the need to sneeze and you know that you shouldn't do it, but what happens eventually? You sneeze. Because when there's a vexation, it has to be released at some point. Sooner or later, it's going to come out. So when you want something, sooner or later, you're going to find some way to get it. And the longer you leave it, the more unbearable it becomes as well. So this is why we are here to tame our minds a different way. We're not here to learn how do we go and get all the things we want. Because that is what we learn at school. How do we get the things we want? That's what we learn at college. That's what we learn at uni. Yeah? That's what we learn by reading books. How do we get the things we want? The 7 habits of highly effective people. How does one become an effective person in getting what they want? But here's what we learn here. How do you stop the wanting? How do we tame ourselves so that we want no more? Because when you have no wanting, now you're free. Now you're free to choose whether you go get it or not. But what about when you want it? Are you free to make that choice? Are you? Are you free to make that choice? Let's say the games are on. What's on these days? I don't know. I don't watch TV. What's on these days? Golf? Rugby? Rugby's on these days. Let's say you want to watch the rugby, but you also have exams. Okay? You've got exams and then there's rugby on. How unthoughtful, right? I mean, who in their sane mind would put rugby on when the exams are on? It's their fault, isn't it? They shouldn't be doing it like that. We talked about this another day. So imagine this situation where you have an exam, or maybe you have an appointment early in the morning, so you have to be up and fresh for that appointment. Maybe you have an interview that you have to get to. It's make or break, but the rugby's on. Do you think you're making a free choice at this point when you decide to go and watch the rugby? Do you think it's a free choice? Do you think it's a free choice? Is it? No. You are now a slave. There are choices that free men make, and there are choices that slaves make. And those choices are not choices at all. Actually, I can make it rhyme. There are choices that free men make, and there are choices that three men make. These three men are the men. Who are weighed by the defilements of desire, aversion, and delusion. Do you make a choice as a free man, or do you make a choice as one of these three men? When you know the rugby's on, but you know that you have to get to bed early, maybe there's an appointment the following day, maybe you shouldn't be staying up so late, right? Maybe you're busy with something, you have lots and plenty of work to do, and you've got to get it all done, but you know, the rugby is pulling you. Saying, come on, honey, come on, you know you want it. I remember a long time ago, many, 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 many moons ago, in one of the sermons, I gave this analogy. And, you know, there are a few young people in the audience, but I think it's okay. I'll give it to you in safe words. Okay? The mind can at times be a prostitute. They want one thing and one thing alone. And when they want that one thing, they will care not what the damage is. They may care not what the collateral damage is. Will I be infected? Will I be harmed? Will I be abused? Care not. Because if there's one thing I want that one thing. When your mind goes into vexation, ladies and gentlemen, you know what I mean by vexation? This wanting feeling when you want something? Yeah? You are not now free to make that choice. You are not free. My job here, my purpose of being here is to help you make these choices freely. When you're not free to make these choices, you're not making those choices at all. It is your vexation that is pulling you in that direction. You're not free. You are a slave to your desires. Have you never felt that you are a slave to your desires? Have you never? Have you never felt that you're a slave to your desires? When desires ignite in your heart, have you never done things where you later thought, I shouldn't have done that? Have you never done things where you felt, you know, oh, in the moment you felt, why do I feel this way? I don't want to feel this way. How can I stop myself from feeling this way? But I want to do it, but I know I shouldn't be doing it. Think about some habits that you might have picked up along the way. I'm not going to name any, but I think, you know, you're all intelligent enough to understand what I'm talking about. Some habits that perhaps, you know, some of you picked up from your younger years. Now when young boys, you know, they come to the monastery and they say, Swami Nuhansa, I've got this problem. I'm not going to name anything, but I think you're intelligent enough to understand what I'm talking about. Let me put it this way. Self-gratification. Make sense? All right. Young people, they come up to us and ask, Swami Nuhansa, I've got this problem. Self-gratification. How do I stop myself? And they tell me this. Swami Nuhansa, I want to stop, but I can't. Because when it hits me, I don't know what to do. I lose my bearings. I know it's wrong. And morally, I know it's wrong. I want to become an anagarika. And I want to come and stay at the monastery, but I can't be staying here when I know that I have this habit and it feels like I have sinned this holy place. How do I stop myself? Please help, they tell me. So if the anagarikas, when they come to us and they want to walk the path to Nibbana, say that, then I can only imagine what the general population must be like. That's just one habit. There'll be plenty more where I know we can all relate to habits that we feel, we know perhaps they're morally wrong, maybe they're legally wrong, right? But maybe doing that is going to destroy our relationships with others, perhaps. It's going to make life difficult for us, certainly, and life hell for us on occasions. There'll be times when these things happen. When desire creeps into the mind. Now, you know, just have a think about why, you know, when some people, they travel in public transport. You know, you've heard these stories. I don't think I need to spell them out to you, but I'll remind you of them because so then you can relate why we need the Dhamma so much. Why is it we come to seek refuge in the triple gem? You know, because there are people who can afford whatever they need. And then there are those who can't. Yeah? Because what you give is what you get, and if they haven't given, then they're not going to get. Then life will be difficult for them to acquire what they need. Okay? But just because people have got things doesn't mean they always use it the right way. That is the second pitfall. Not getting what you want is the first pitfall. The second one is once you get it, you use it the wrong way. And that is where a lot of people end up losing everything they have. Yeah? I've seen that happen so many times, ladies and gentlemen. I think, you know, we are fortunate enough to be speaking to an audience where, you know, I'm not making any stereotypes, but generally speaking, I think, you know, you are well off. You can manage to live your lives comfortably. But there are occasions where we have to go to rural places and then speak to people, you know, they can barely make ends meet. For them, a Sunday morning sermon every week is just unaffordable. Because they have to be up climbing up the coconut trees or going out to sea or going out to the paddy fields or going out to someone's home to do some labor so that they can make the ends meet. You don't have to do that. You're fortunate. Fortunate meaning you have the merits that were acquired which have now given you this opportunity to be here today. But what I have also seen is when people don't realize what they've got and how difficult it was to acquire that, and why we have what we have today. And then they just go on spending without a care, carefree, and sometimes using it the wrong way. And soon enough, sooner than it got to them, they lose it all. So that's another sidetrack. Coming back to the point. There are people who can afford what they want and there are people who can't afford what they want. Let's just say there's someone who wishes to indulge in fantasies. I'm using safe words because there are children in the audience. They want to indulge in fantasies. So if your child today goes and asks, Ami, 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 what is Swaminathan about fantasy? Put out that fantasy world. We go on the rides, that one. For those who understand what I'm saying, then as you understand it, they want to indulge in fantasies, but they don't have the means to afford it because it's too expensive. So then what do? They look for ways and means to acquire what they want, but unlawfully, illegally, and sometimes in morally very wrong ways. So, this man gets on a bus. Perhaps some of you might have been on the receiving end of this. It's quite possible. One intention of me sharing these stories with you is so that you don't have anger and hatred towards them, but rather you have mercy towards them and look at them with compassion. Because they're not bad people. It's what happens when vexation hits the mind. There are no bad people in this world. There are just vexed minds. If there are bad people in this world, then you're all bad in some way. Agreed? You're all bad in some way. If you're eating something you shouldn't be eating, aren't you bad? You're bad. If you're looking at something you shouldn't be looking at, aren't you bad? Yeah, you might be doing it lawfully. You might be paying your bills for it, but you're looking at something you shouldn't be looking at. You're bad. That's what I'm saying. There are no bad people in this world. What there are vexed minds. That is why we treat them here. Vexed minds. So have you never seen this man who gets on the bus, right, and he has, let's just say, a rash that needs itching. He has a rash that needs itching. So he'll look for someone who can scratch his rash. And usually if this is a man, then he thinks that it's only a woman that can scratch my rash. But sometimes it can be maybe a young boy. Looks cute. Looks cute. Maybe he's in his school uniform. In shorts, even better. Don't give me that look. Why are you all looking at me like you're gobsmacked? You know? I'm only telling you what's happening out there in society. I'm not making this stuff up. I've seen it all. I'm just sharing these stories with you so that you begin to understand why people behave in this manner. Psychology will teach you behavior. Psychology will not teach you how the mind works. They won't teach you what is behind the behavior. For that you need Buddhist philosophy. Psychology will only teach you behavior. You can study behaviors with psychology, but not the root behind those behaviors. So that man on the bus, he's looking for the bus driver to apply the brakes. Yeah? Because when the brakes are applied, the throng of people, they get pushed to one side and the rash gets scratched once. And it feels good. And then they're waiting for the next bus halt. And they're waiting for the next traffic light. And they're waiting for the next application of the brakes, the sudden brakes. That's what they're waiting for. But two or three times when it happens, people begin to get wind of this. People standing either side, perhaps the victim, begins to realize something else is going on here. Sorry if I'm opening up an old wound. I don't know. Because there may be some here who've been on the receiving end of that. Perhaps you looked at, in that situation, all you felt was hatred, perhaps. You felt anger. You felt that you were victimized. Dear ladies and gentlemen, I appeal to you, think outside that box. Step out. Come to your senses. There are no bad or evil people in this world. There are just defilements. Raga, Dvesha and Moha are the defilements that get people to do these things. They are the demons, they are the devils. Have compassion. See, that man would probably have observed the precepts before he left home. Maybe the previous day he even offered alms to the monks. And before the alms offering, he observed the precepts. Kamesu micchachara veramani sikkhapadan samadhiyami. So he thought the precept that he was observing meant I refrain from engaging in sexual or sensual misconduct. That's what he thought. But that is not what it means. Superficially, yes, but underlying, there's a much deeper meaning, which is what I'm trying to get across to you here. What is necessary, ladies and gentlemen, is not the discipline of not engaging in that. What is required is the insight, the wisdom, the training through wisdom, so that you don't feel the need to do it. You don't feel the desire for it. You are free from the wanting for it. And when that happens, no more problems. But what happens to that man two or three times later and people start picking up that something else is going on here, and then what does he usually end up with? A black eye. Have you not seen this happen? Oh, I have seen enough times. You know, en route to school, I used to take the bus those days. Right, en route to school, you know, there'd be girls and boys in the bus. And, you know, this would be prime time for some individuals who would come seeking pleasures of the flesh. Their carnal desires, which cannot be satisfied at home, and if they don't have the money to go and get it from other places, then they victimize. Those days I used to think, you know, burn them alive. How terrible these men are. Flay them alive if possible. How terrible these people are. To be doing these things to innocent children. That's how I used to think. I'm sorry. I was wrong. If everyone thought that way, today we wouldn't have Angulimala Maharatan once. Agreed? If everyone thought that way, if he thought that way, we wouldn't have had Angulimala Maharatan once. Because what the Buddha knew was, if there are no bad people, there are defilements in the mind that makes one to behave in a bad way. Folks, I need you to start seeing the world in this way. It requires great maturity to look at the world in this way. You have to have a very open mind. And it has to be a very practical approach. You have to be very pragmatic. Be very broad-minded to look at the world in this way. But what I'm not suggesting for certainly is, say if someone's doing something like that to you, you know, you just think, not a bad man, just raga, dvesha, moha. I'm not asking you to just stand there and let him do whatever he wants to do. You know, get out of that place. Take yourself to safety. Like if it's someone you know, take them to safety. But don't hold anything against the person that's doing it, because they are simply a victim. Just as much as you feel the child is a victim of that man, the man is a victim of raga, dvesha and moha. So if you are looking for the person to be what? If you are looking for the person that needs help, you think it's the child. Perhaps. I think everyone knows that. But I see that the man needs help. bring him here if you can. But what normally happens? He gets a black eye and then he gets handcuffed, perhaps taken into a cell somewhere, and then rest is history. Do you think in the prisons they teach people anicca, dukkha and anatta? We do sermons in prisons. And on one of these occasions, I got the opportunity to speak to the chief commissioner of prisons. And the gentleman told me, "Swaminathan sir, I well and truly believe that the prison system cannot reform people. We need your help," he said. That is what we're doing now. We're working with them. How does beating someone up physically help rid the mind of desire, aversion and delusion? What were you doing all the while then? I have to ask the Buddha. If beating people up and punishing them can rid the mind of raga, dvesha and moha, why preach the Dhamma? I'll tell you what happens in the prisons though. Perhaps someone gets locked up for petty theft. Right? What they know is petty theft. But they get locked up with people who are habitual criminals. Now, like you come here every Sunday morning to listen to me speak, they get a Sunday morning lecture from whom? From whom? From criminals. Remember the two parrots? One fell on the side of the ascetics, the other fell on the side of thieves. So what do you think is going to happen when someone who's a delinquent or perhaps someone who's just committed petty theft ends up in prison? Now they spend the rest of the 6 months, 3 months, you know, a year, 2 years, however long they'll take to process those people amongst people, other people who have done far more sins, far more crimes than they have, and they continuously get fed into their minds other new, interesting and innovative ways of committing crime. So now when you release them back into society, what do you expect? Has the problem lessened or worsened? You be the judge of that. Which brings me back to the point. Discipline perhaps is what they try and do there. Stand out of line and they get beaten up. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. The same. Speak out of step and perhaps they get punished. Maybe locked up in a dark room. Misbehave and perhaps they get punished. Maybe they have to skip a meal altogether. Maybe they get thrashed. Maybe they get whipped. Perhaps. Now I know in certain countries, in certain prisons, these things happen. Oh, I mean, come on. I don't think you need me to tell you this. In some countries, in some prisons that are overpopulated, right? Now, last time I was looking up stats, in Sri Lanka, the Sri Lankan prison system, we are at 180% occupation. Not 100%, not 80%, 180% occupation rate. So the prisons are occupied 180 times their maximum capacity. Or rather 1.8 times their maximum capacity. In other countries, it is much worse. There are countries where it is much worse. And what do they get there? Beatings, thrashings, physical torture. Meaningless. You can't make someone by disciplining them. That is why in the Buddha's teachings, ladies and gentlemen, as we come here every morning and we observe the precepts. I need you to understand this and this alone, if nothing more. Panatipata, adinna dana, kami sumichachara, musavada, and suramere majjvama datta. Those are all end results. What you are observing is the Dhamma. What you are going to observe while you are here, while you are present here, is the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, the Noble Eightfold Path. When the Noble Eightfold Path begins to seep into you and begins to start making an internal change within you, you will no longer want to steal. You will no longer want to kill. You will no longer want to lie. You will no longer want to engage in misconduct. Because when you want something, you will somehow go and get it. Being wealthy in these days is a big thing, because what does wealth enable you to do? Get what you want. That's what wealth enables you to do. That's okay, that's good. But that doesn't solve the problem. Because they're still a poor man. Internally, they're poor. Why poor? Because they still rely on their wealth. A rich man internally doesn't rely on their wealth. But a poor man internally relies on their wealth. If I need you to keep me happy, do you think I'm a happy man? Answer that question. If I need a woman to keep me happy, do you think I'm a happy man? Do you? No. If I need money to keep me happy, do you think I'm a rich man? There you go. If you need something external to keep you happy, then that is by which you are poor. If you need food to keep you happy, you are a poor man. It is food that has made you poor. If you need money to keep you happy, then you are a poor man because of the money. If you need cars, you know, there are people out there who they enjoy their cars, their motors, right? There are those who like their jewelry. Some people like to wear a nice watch, maybe to have some nice jewelry on. For some people, it's just the cap that they wear. For them, it is everything. For some people, it's their music. For some people, it's what they watch on TV, their Netflix. Without that, they couldn't survive. For some people, it's a bottle. The golden juice that goes in the bottle. For some people, it is that. Happiness comes in a bottle for them. Where does your happiness come? What shape does it come in? I ask you. Does it come in the shape of a cake? Where do you get your happiness from? Your happiness shots, where do you get them from? Do they come in bottles? Do they come on four wheels? Do they go around your wrist? Or do you have to hold their hand? Do you have to put a ring on it? Whatever it is you need to keep you happy, please remember and remind yourself that by that much you are unhappy. You are poor. That is why you are here, to try and free yourself from all that so you can be self-sufficient. You don't need to rely on anything else. You don't need the external stimuli. You don't need the external things, the material things to keep you happy. My monkhood is not my robes and my shaved head, ladies and gentlemen. It's the mental aptitude that I've been able to build up to be free from the things around me. Take anything that is you see on me, and you can't take my happiness from me. If you wish one day to come and take my alms bowl from me, you don't have to steal it. I will give it to you. Just ask for it. If you need the robe that goes around my body, you don't have to steal it. Just ask for it. I will give it to you. So much so that if I take it back from you, I am committing a crime. In the Buddha's ministry, what is given is given. What is given up is given up. To this day, I have never regretted anything I have given up. Never. I have never batted an eyelid about a thing I have given up. And that is because all that given up was given up in my mind. Before the physical giving up happened, the mental giving up had happened. That is what the Dhamma can do for me. And if that is what the Dhamma can do for me, then it can do the same for you. Don't be so poor that you need things around you to keep you happy. Don't be so poor. Stand up on your own two feet. Stand up for yourself. Have a rich mindset. It's not enough to have a rich bank account. Have a rich mindset. That is what I'm asking you to do. Have a rich mindset. A rich mindset is a mindset that does not need other things, does not need material things, does not need other people to make them happy because they are rich. Are you rich? I ask you. Then I'll ask you this question soon enough. What makes you poor? What have you allowed to make you poor? Now make a mental note of the things that you have allowed to make yourself poor. All the things that you can't live without are the things that have made you poor. Because here's what I can do. I can take them away from you and leave you crying. And leave you in despair. There can be people. It could be your mother, could be your father, could be your husband, could be your wife, could be your children. Could be people. It could also be material things. It could be your titles. Maybe you have a title that you wear with pride. It is my title. An honorary title perhaps. What if they take it away from you? Maybe the president of the country has given you a title, but he changes his mind. Or there's a coup against you. And then they decide that you no longer should be bearing that title and they confiscate it, take it back from you. Now, how does that make you feel? Perhaps right now you'll say, it's all right, Swami, but let's see when it happens. It's one thing to say, and it's another when it actually happens. And I speak to the mothers in this room. Dear mothers, are you poor because of your children? If fate would take your child away from you, how would you feel right now? Don't worry, I'm not going to take your child away from you. You can keep your child. But what if fate takes your child away from you? How would that make you feel? Where would you be left? Are you so rich then? What is your richness? I'm only rich until my child is with me. Then what happens when your child leaves? What happens when your child dies? What happens then? Where's your richness? Are you rich because you have a nice home? What if that burns down? Now you'll say, well, how often does something like that happen, Swami Nohansa? Yes. So does everyone say that? Everyone says that. Everyone says that. My point is not whether you have it or not. My point is, you still want it, don't you? If you're not sure you've locked your house as you leave home, what do? You come halfway and then do what again? Turn around and you have to go back. Never happened? Oh, of course. Been there, done that, haven't we? Haven't we all? Why do you go back? Because you're scared. You're worried. See, that has stolen your happiness. Now again, that's not me saying, so what? Go and leave your house and live in the jungle. No. Have the house. I'm talking about the fear that creeps into your mind. I'm talking about the worry that has overtaken you. Why live in fear and worry? Fear and worry are not products of having or not having a house. Fear and worry are products of tanha, attachment, craving. We are here not to let go of all the physical and material things we hold. We are here to let go of attachment and then make use of everything. I've said this to you before. Use anything and everything. Own nothing. Ownership is only a perception. It's not the document. It's not the document. You'll sign the title deed and say, this belongs to me now, I own it. Fair enough, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the perception of ownership. Because what you'll fight for in court is not what the paperwork says. What you'll fight for in court is what your perception says. When you want something, even if it's something that belongs to somebody else, you'll still fight for it if you want it. You know, the reason that you and your neighbors are living happily just yet is because your neighbor still doesn't feel that he wants to be with your wife. That's why. How do you stop that from happening? You can't. But what if Mr. Richard, just next door, one morning, you know, out of nowhere, he begins to feel an attraction towards your wife? Now how do you live happily with your neighbors? See, from that day on, count the days forward, and the day where you are going to split up is just around the corner. The day where your family is going to break up is just around the corner. Worst of all, what if your feeling is mutual? Are you telling me that these things don't happen? If so, I will take all this back. I'll eat my words. Are you telling me these things don't happen? Huh? Really? Oh, they happen every day. But there's nothing people can do about it. They can fight over it. They can break up over it and try and move on and try and mend their minds, but that's it. Until the next event. See, from event after event, we just keep moving from predicament to predicament. We just keep jumping from one lurch to the next. That is why we are not here to talk about disciplining. We are here to talk about understanding, realizing. I'm trying to help you all free yourselves from the wanting that you all experience for whatever it might be, anything under the sun. If there's anything that you still want in your heart, that wanting brings you torture. It brings you torment. It keeps you awake at night. It steals your happiness. It steals your peace. Does it not? Aren't there things that make you worried? If you say for your children go to school, or they go to a tuition class, right? Or maybe they're just going out to town to be with friends. Do you remember when they had the the social unrest? There was going on around the country a while ago. Yeah. Let's just say, back then, if you wanted your children, if your children had to go to school, or they had to go for something, your husband had to go to work, your wife had to go to the school, maybe your wife had school, she's a teacher, or maybe your wife had to go somewhere, right? Someone in the family had to go somewhere. How did you feel until they got home and until you knew that they were safe? And on the news, they're always talking about, bombs going off and, all this unrest going on. How did you feel at the time? You were worried. You were stressed. A lot of people developed stress back then. Some developed depression. Because what people don't understand is, how do they free their minds from wanting? Freeing the mind from wanting, I'll be quick to remind you here, that freeing the mind from wanting is not freeing yourself from duty and responsibility. They're very different things. To fulfill a duty and a responsibility, you just need to understand what it is that is required for their safety, for their well-being, for their upbringing. Right? So as a husband, you have a duty towards your wife. As a wife, you have a duty towards your husband. As parents, you have a duty and a responsibility towards your children. As an employee, you have a duty towards your workplace. As a citizen, we have a duty to our country. As a global citizen, we have a duty to the whole world that we live in. Duties and responsibilities are one. Attachment and the suffering that comes with it are something completely different. Otherwise, do you know of anyone who shirked his duties more than the Buddha? What did he do? Did he not fulfill his duty? Do you think I'd be here if it wasn't for the Buddha? When did he set forth the sasana? Before becoming a Buddha or after? When did he create the sasana? After becoming the Buddha. That is when he started ordaining people, men and women, and giving them the sasana, giving them instruction to go forth and help people to save themselves and attain nibbana and to do good to others. See, that was his duty, that was his obligation, his responsibility. He did that, he fulfilled that, but he never suffered. That's what I'm saying. Suffering is one, fulfilling duty and responsibility is another. It's not one and the same. So don't fool yourselves ever, and don't let anyone tell you either otherwise. Some will come and tell you otherwise. Don't be going to these sermons, you know, if you do so, you know, soon enough you will stop being part of us, you will give up your duties and response, you won't care about the children, you won't care about me, you won't care about the house, you won't care about the bills. Huh? Then what's gonna happen? This whole place will just become a mess. Your first responsibility, your first duty is to me as your wife, as your husband, people will might remind you. I beg to differ. Your first duty is to yourself. Your first responsibility is to yourself. And here's why. It is not a selfish thought. It's a very selfless thought. Here's why. If you can't look after yourself, if you can't help yourself, if you can't be happy, how can you look after, do good, and make someone else happy? Do you not remember? I'll just take a very simple example. Do you not remember the look on your wife's face that day when you got mad at her? When you got angry? And you just started throwing things around and started shouting at the top of your voice. Do you remember the look on her face? Yeah? So are you telling me that your first duty is to her? Is it not to yourself? Because if you didn't get angry that day, wouldn't she have been happy? Half of everything she suffers, you bring it home. Half of everything he suffers, you bring it home. So if you looked after yourself, if you fixed yourself, if you could stop yourself from feeling angry, feeling disappointed, feeling frustrated, feeling annoyed, and, you know, feeling desire towards things and people and others that you shouldn't be feeling, now you become a blessing to be around. But otherwise, you're just a ticking time bomb. You never know when. Don't you live with some people who you never know when? It's like the dog, you know, if you step on its tail, you never know when. It's going to turn around and bark and bite you. Is your husband the same? I ask you. Just give me a virtual nod. Don't properly nod. Is your son the same? Maybe your loving son. You brought him up, you fed him, you taught him. He's now 25 years old. But he's like he's on dynamite. Right? Just the wrong word is said. Or say if he doesn't get what he wants, the way he wants it, he goes mad. He throws things around. Sometimes, you know, he even threatens you. Threatens to hit you. He doesn't realize that he's speaking to his mother. These things happen everywhere, not just your home. It happens everywhere. So relax. It happens everywhere. Is that a reason to relax? Because it happens everywhere and it's on the newspapers. That's what I'm saying, folks. We need to fix it. And we fix it by fixing ourselves. That is why your first duty is to yourself. Fulfill that duty. And as you fulfill that duty, we mustn't forget the duty and responsibility that we have to others. That is why the parents here who bring their children here, I have a lot of regard and respect for them. At least those who try. I know that for some of you, you try, but they're not interested. They're not so keen. Yet. But those who do, hats off to you. Because here's you fulfilling your duty and responsibility to your children. Because what you have learned and realized today is, yes, you gave them a good education, a world-class education. You fed them well. You housed them. You clothed them. You gave them every comfort that you could afford. But if you haven't taught them how to free themselves from desire, how to free themselves from anger, how to free themselves from delusion, soon enough they'll get themselves into big trouble because they won't know how to live with their wife one day if they get married. They won't know how to settle problems with their siblings. Because when everyone wants the bigger piece, now no one's happy. If you don't give them the Dhamma soon enough, your own children will be fighting with each other. Perhaps when they were younger, they fought for a toy, but later on they'll be fighting for the property that you leave behind. And the very property that you leave behind for them will be the reason that they will split up and will no longer see eye to eye. Then you'll begin to question yourself, was it all worth it? I thought this would help my children live a happy life, but look at what I've done in the end. I thought when I let them inherit whatever I have passed on to them, they'll be able to live happily. But what I didn't teach them is how to share, how to care, how to free the mind from wanting, how to rejoice in another person's happiness. That I didn't teach them. But I taught them math, science and chemistry and physics and biology. I taught them how to become a doctor. But what I didn't teach them is how to live as a good human being. So, Panatipata, that is the end result. Adinnadana is the end result. Kamesu Michachara is the end result. Musavada, Parusavacha, these are the 10 unwholesome deeds, but you have Suramere Majjha Madatta, Veramani. These are all the end results. Veramani is to refrain, yes. Is to refrain, mentally refrain. To mentally refrain from that, you have to mentally be able to not want it, to not desire it. For that, we need to understand the doctrine. Once you understand the doctrine, you will no longer feel the urge for it. When you don't feel the urge for it, then it matters not whether you have it or not. So that is the peace of mind that we have all come for, to seek in the sasana. But of course, every morning before we start, I will be precepting you. But what I need you to understand, one, it's a custom. So much so that if I didn't precept you, people would start asking me questions. Why did you not precept the audience before you start? Shall I give you a good question, something to think about? Do you remember the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta? The first ever discourse delivered by the Buddha. Okay? If you ever get the chance to read the Sutta in a Pirit book, or a Tripitaka, have you ever seen the Buddha precepting them before starting the sermon? Does the Buddha say, "All right, five ascetics, please sit down, take off your hats, take off your shoes." They didn't have hats and shoes, fair enough. Right? Sit down, now say, "Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi." And then have you ever read or heard anywhere where the Buddha said, "Panatipata, Veramani, Sikkha Padang, Samadhyami"? Have you ever? No. Here's what the Buddha says. Dveme bhikkhave anta, pabbajitena nasevitabba. Monks, hear me. There are two extremes that a monk should not pursue. And he starts his talk. Take the example of Angulimala, for instance. Right, he was running after the Buddha, wanting what? His finger. Right? So as he was running after the Buddha, do you think the Buddha had the time to say, "Angulimala, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi." Do you think the Buddha had time to say that? No, the Buddha directly went into his discourse. "Angulimala, I have stopped. Why are you still running? You asking me to stop. I have stopped. Why are you running?" Those words were so profound. Angulimala was a clever one. So he realized what the Buddha is saying is he has stopped seeking pleasure from the outside world. So therefore he has stopped running. This is a metaphor. Angulimala understands this. Why are you still running? Meaning, why are you still seeking pleasures from the outside world? Do you not understand that vexation is a creation of your own mind? Do you not understand that happiness is yours and you don't need to seek it from the outside? All of this contained in a few words, and Angulimala being such an intellectual, having the wisdom to understand this, he grasps it. And so he kneels and he says, "Venerable sir, I have understood. This is the truth I have been seeking so far. Please carry on with your talk." Never in the Angulimala Sutra was it ever said that the Buddha precepted the Angulimala. But having delivered the sermon, Angulimala from then on refrained from killing, refrained from stealing, refrained from engaging in sexual misconduct, refrained from lying, and refrained from what you call is taking intoxicants. What that means, I will talk about on another day, because that is a whole discourse on its own. What is this Surame Re Majjapama that time? For now, you can think it's just only take a little bit. Carry on with that. One day we will talk about it. The true meaning behind each of these precepts. And then you will be mesmerized. My gosh, and I thought I knew the Buddha. You will utter these words. When you really realize, truly realize one day, I never realized that the Buddha was so profound, so wise. He is the sage. You will say one day, you will utter these words one day. For now, take a little, not more. See, never in the Angulimala Sutra does the Buddha precept Angulimala. But here's what happens. He delivers the sermon. At the end of that, Angulimala has arrived at the point where he no longer steals, he no longer kills, he no longer lies, he no longer engages in misconduct. See? That's what I'm saying. He has received the training through the teaching, through the Four Noble Truths. That is the training. The Four Noble Truths is the training. And that training enables anyone who goes through that to achieve that state of mind where you don't need to kill. You don't need pleasures from the outside world. You don't need to steal. You know, discipline is good for others, but it's hurtful for you, is it not? Think about it for a second. We'll conclude on that. Right? But discipline is good for others. When you discipline yourself, it's good for others. But is it not hurtful for you? Say, for take the simple example, you want to smoke. Right? You want to smoke a cigarette. But it says, no smoking. How is that good for? Others. Because others are not inconvenienced by your smoking. But who is it not good for? I mean, I don't mean, I'm not referring to the health damage. I'm talking about just, you know, if you want to smoke, right? And you want to smoke now, right? And that would be good. That would be pleasurable for you. That would be enjoyable for you. But you can't do it now because there's a discipline that says, don't smoke. It's good for others, but it's not good for you. That's why you leave the room, go somewhere where it says, it's okay to smoke, and you smoke there. Or there might be a board that says, please don't use your mobile phone. Or please have your phone on silent. Don't use your mobile phone. Or no speaking, no talking. Right? Why is that? It's good for others. Because perhaps there's an exam ongoing. Maybe silence is required. But if you need to talk, now that board, that rule is an impeachment on your happiness, is it not? It's an impediment to your happiness. It's a hindrance to your happiness. So what must you do? Take yourself away and do it and then come back. But what if you didn't need to make that phone call? What if you didn't need to talk? What if you didn't need to look around? I'll give you one final example and we'll conclude for today. Let's just imagine the king of the land laid down a rule, okay, to all the men. You are forbidden from looking at women from here on. If you look at a woman, you will be beheaded. Now, if the king, you know, it's the king is the king, right? So the king can lay down whatever rules he wants. Just imagine, if you were the subjects, and the king lays down a rule, if you but look, just look at a woman, you shall be beheaded. Are you all okay with that? Just give me a virtual nod. I can ask the same of the women. Why is that a problem? Because you want to look. When you want to do something, if people try and stop you from doing it, you feel vexed. You feel bothered. You feel annoyed. But what if you don't want to look? This is the same principle we try to teach at the prisons. We still try to. In some prisons, punishment is locking people up in a dark room. Why is that a punishment, I ask you? Why is locking someone up in a dark room a punishment? Because they want to see. For someone who wishes to see things, darkness is a punishment. But what if you didn't want to see? How can someone who doesn't want anything be punished? Punish an arahant, I dare you. Did you catch that? Punish an arahant if you can. You can't. Because that happiness is self-contained. It doesn't come from the outside. That is why when we go and speak to prisoners, we talk to them. Sir, today you feel that you are being punished because you are within these four walls and you want to go out. We explain to them that there is nothing worthy of going out seeking. Now they are happy being there. We take away the punishment from the prisoners. That's what the Dhamma can do. Isn't that wonderful? If we can free prisoners from their own punishment. So it is not the officials that punish them. They punish themselves. Just like you punish yourselves. No one punishes you. You punish yourself. You punish yourself by wanting things that you don't have. If I can give you the teaching that helps you to free yourself from that wanting, then you are no longer in punishment. You are freed. So, come all ye who are weary and burdened, and I shall set you free. Because the Buddha's teaching is here to set you all free. More on that next week. Right, so let's transfer the merits then and bring today's sermon to a close. First and foremost then, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, let us transfer these merits to them for having protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passing them down through the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters, who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that amongst them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhansi, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by translating these sermons, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May, by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plain. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to friends of the monastery, devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May by the power of these merits, they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employees, our teachers, and to all those mentioned, as well as those who have failed to mention, those who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. And by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves towards the betterment and fulfillment of the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us also transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. And by the power of these merits, may they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name, our loved ones, those who have predeceased us, our ancestors, our forefathers. As it is in their efforts, today we enjoy the comforts we do. May they all rejoice in the merits that we have acquired today. Let us also transfer these merits to those who make great sacrifices to protect the peace and harmony of our nation and to lead our nation to greatness. May they all rejoice in these merits. May those who have lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe, also rejoice in all these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to those who would have lost their lives in natural disasters, such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, forest fires, blizzards, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that amongst them will be those who have been friends and family to us in this long journey of samsara, and those who will have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, say redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Teranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnin midatva Dvesha ginnin midatva Moha ginnin midatva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetma Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetma Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetma Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha වන් සපල දේවා නිවන් සපල දේවා නිවන් සපල දේවා
තුන්රුවන්ගේ සූසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බලෙන් සීල ලෝක සීල සත්‍යවම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුගතතර වෙත්වා සාදු සාදු සාදු